You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. Today's podcast is with Stephanie Weaver, who is a writer, speaker coach, wellness advocate, and food blogger based in San Diego, California. She has worked as a technical writer for more than 20 years in the nonprofit sector. She is a highly rated workshop presenter and speaker coach, having coached more than three dozen TEDx speakers, including actor Richard Dreyfuss and business coach Ken Blanchard, and me. But we'll get to that. She is the author of many books, but most recent book is called Bittersweet, How to Heal Yourself When Your Family is Broken. We do want to note that this episode will contain frank discussions of family sexual abuse, so please listen with care and enjoy the pod. Stephanie Weaver, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Kelly. It's great to be here.
All right. So we know each other for a while. So this is my memory of this, which was in 2017 or 2018. I forget which. I was asked to do a TED-style talk for the National Investment Center for Seniors Housing and Care, NIC. They informed all the speakers that they would be provided a coach. And my immediate response to this was, I don't need a coach. I've been doing public speaking for three decades. Now, some part of me must have known that I was being an asshole because I laid out the situation to my colleague, Jenna Stege. And I talk about this. I don't know if you know this. So this is like part of my thing often when I talk about storytelling. And I told her about this, and there's a coach, and she said something like, oh, yes, Kelly Leonard has nothing to learn about public speaking from anyone else. So the truth hurts. And I went ahead and set up a meeting with you. And not only did you help me make my talk better, it's 10 years later, and we're friends. We're still friends. And so happy ending. But I'm just sort of, I don't know what your end of that whole thing was, because I don't know how much we've talked about it and what kind of reluctance you get from other folks. But I'm sort of curious if you'd run across that before.
Sure. So I've been a TED-style speaking coach for 15 years. I coached over 300 speakers in total-ish. And I get either hired by individuals who are paying me to help them, and they are very motivated. And then yeah. I also will get hired by an organization like NIC or the National Center for Organ Donation Alliance. I work with them now. And they'll get the people lined up, and then they'll kind of give them to me. And so there, it's a varying degree of buy-in because they're not paying for it. And also people don't realize how much work they are. So then they get halfway through and they're like, oh my God, what have I signed up for? And so I have to be really flexible. But I think the best example of this, of which kind of this reluctance that you spoke about, the anti version of that is Ken Blanchard, who is business coach, been around forever, written 50 plus books. The 1 Minute Manager is probably his most well-known book, but he's been around for a long time. And I was assigned to Ken, I think in my second year of coaching for TEDx San Diego. And Ken 100% could have said, I do not need a coach, right? Because literally, like, what can you teach Ken Blanchard about public speaking? Like, that's what he does. He's a, you know, but Ken is a lifelong learner. And he said, oh, I'm sure I could learn something from Stephanie. And I thought, well, that's cool, you know, because I definitely have had people that were like, I don't need a coach. And they don't usually do as well as the people who say yes to me, honestly, because I can help for a lot of different reasons. But what I loved about working with Ken, I had to find a story he hadn't told before, which is not easy because, you know, Ken's talked about everything, but somehow he'd never talked about collaboration. So we found three stories that he never told about collaboration that were about him becoming a writer and a business writer. And my favorite thing about Ken was that he was the final speaker of our day. It was a full day. And he could have just swanned in, you know, 45 minutes before and had his makeup done. He was there the entire day in the green room, encouraging other speakers, talking to people who were nervous, taking notes. And there was this moment I'll just never forget where he was sitting on the couch with a musician from a group called Unknown Lyric, which is a rap violin combination. Super cool. So the guy's like in his 20s with, you know, dreads and the whole thing. And the speaker on stage had put up a picture of the March on Washington. And I hear, because I'm sitting behind Ken, oh, Dr. King was such a nice man. Hmm. And this musician whipped his head around and was like, you knew Dr. King? And he said, well, I knew Malcolm X better. And then it was like half an hour of the two of them just like it could have been like a highlight of the musician's life. And that for me was such an incredible gift, but also such a lesson. Like, be in the room, pay attention, be available to other people, be open to the process.
I think too, as you were talking, I realized, well, I never even for a minute doubted I needed an editor for my book. And the editor was incredible. So I wonder, and maybe the disconnect is that the intimacy of that sort of public speaking when you do it a lot. And I've done this like since, I mean, I was a producer at Second City at 26. So, you know, and come from a showbiz family and all that. That you feel like, oh no, I have a sense of mastery about it, but and perhaps I do, but every venue is different, and I think the TED or TEDx format itself requires a different kind of shape, because yeah, I'm good on a stage, I know how to modulate, you didn't have to worry about like that kind of stuff. However, it was the shaping of what stories, when, you know, how is I going to incorporate? Because the talk we were giving was a caregiving audience, and my daughter was in the hospital. So I was literally like, I came from the hospital, was going back to it. And I think that's when we sort of decided like, yeah, you can incorporate that for sure. You need to inside the story. And I wonder for yourself, because you do public speaking, like the doing and the coaching are really kind of worlds apart, right?
I've learned a lot about improving my own speaking by being a coach. I never used to rehearse anywhere near as much as I do now. The format of the TED Talks, the reason they're so popular is because they're about a single idea, which is not the case for a keynote or other types, or, you know, a pitch or different types of speaking that people might do. A presentation might be, you know, a work presentation might be about 10 ideas, right? So they're about a single idea that's supposed to make the world a better place. That's the conceit of it, if you want to call it that. But I really look to find the story for, help the person find the story behind the facts. And so I do this process that I call the nugget, where I interview the people. I have a 10 session process, and the first one is an hour. And I'll ask them, you know, about their hobbies and their background and where they grew up. And what I'm looking for is something that can act as a metaphor for the talk and kind of frame the talk, but also I want to see them light up when they talk about it. And so, you know, one woman, every time she was a foster children founder of a nonprofit, and she'd given her founder's talk many, many times. She had been a CNN Hero of the Year, and but that's not a TED Talk. It's not, you know, that's like a this happened, then this happened, then this happened. And every time I met with her, somehow she would bring up high-heeled stilettos. Like, and it was like the third time she mentioned it, I was like, Danielle, tell me about the shoes. Like, what's the deal with the shoes? And so then she was like, oh my God. And her face lights up and she talks about how she loves shoes and has all these shoes. And in fact, they had this really superficial lifestyle before they founded this nonprofit. and she doesn't even wear the shoes anymore. So it became this whole thing that was actually a beautiful metaphor for the story she was trying to tell, because the number one thing foster children need is shoes for school, for prom, for, you know, work interviews. And so we were able to incorporate that into her talk. And it was a really beautiful way of framing her bigger story. And the other thing about TEDx is it's short. Like, they're short talks. The shortest I've ever coached is 3 minutes and the longest is 15. So I tell people it's really like haiku. Like, every word has to count. You can't have extraneous stuff in there. And that's where my museum background, I used to write the scripts for exhibitions. And that was the exact same thing. Like, you can't tell, you know, the world about everything you know about your PhD, because no one's going to read that, right? You have to break it down into little bite-sized things, but everything needs to relate to each other.
So sometimes we have hard stories to tell. I certainly know when I was back on the speaker circuit after Nora passed, it was like, how am I incorporating this? And it actually ended up being fairly natural. There were some talks where it didn't come up. There were many talks where it did. And it didn't matter. It wasn't like the audience. It was like, oh, this audience is going to be cool with it or whatever. It was more of like, is it germane? It's always germane to me. Is it germane to what's going on in this room right now and the conversation that I'm having? And your new book is not easy material from your life. And I'm curious, prior to the writing, had you verbally, how were you telling that story, if you were telling that story, to both yourself, to anyone else? Because writing on a paper, I get, did it come out in other ways?
So I did a lot of therapy and journaling the shorthand is, when I was 30, I was living in Chicago at the time, my second favorite city. Now I live in San Diego for a long time, but Chicago's really like my first home. And I started having these nightmares. That's where the book starts. And I basically got back memories of childhood sexual abuse. And there's not a lot of it in the book, but I kind of needed to share, like, this is what was going on. And this is why I ended up having to estrange myself from my parents for 16 years. And so I worked on that in therapy for a really long time, but it was hard to tell people. Part of it is, it feels like such a bombshell. Yeah. And I'm sure you can relate to that when someone is talking about their kid and you're like, well, my daughter died. You know, it's kind of like, where do you fit that in? Like, this hard stuff, right? So I hadn't planned on writing a memoir, but what happened was my dad had passed, my mom passed, and I inherited her recipe box. And there was so much in there about her life and my life and our family's life. And going back to when she was probably in steno school in the 30s, you know, because there was early 40s, because there was a couple typewritten yellowed, you know, ones that I'm sure she must have typed up. And so I started thinking about, what would it be like to tell this story? And I really wanted to tell it because I did forgive my parents, even though they never apologized. And I did reconcile with them, even though they never apologized and never acknowledged that this had happened. And I felt like that was an important story to tell. There's a lot of trauma memoirs out there. There are a lot of great trauma memoirs out there. I didn't really feel like I needed to add to that canon. You know, it's like, if you, and you shouldn't try to measure one against the other, but I'm like, if you read Educated, she had like a horrific childhood, and mine, you know, like, literally we could have had a white picket fence at our house. Like, I had 3 meals a day, clean clothes, very normal, I'm air quoting here for those of you listening, life, except for this terrible thing that happened at night. And so it was trying to figure out, I didn't even really want to write about that part. I really wanted to write about my relationship with my mother and trying to parse that after she died through the stories of the recipes. And so it wasn't until I ended up reframing the book around estrangement that it had to start in a different place. I had to put my dad in there way more than I wanted to. And then I had to explain what happened to me, or it wouldn't have made sense to people.
Was it during therapy? Was it in the writing of the book that you realized how just tragically common family estrangement is?
Yeah. So initially it was a forgiveness book in my mind. It wasn't an estrangement book. And obviously the childhood sexual abuse is 1 in 4 women. And I think it's 1 in 7 boys. So that's tragically common. And it wasn't until I was really just having trouble selling it. I was pitching it to agents and, you know, I'm not famous. I don't have 100,000 followers somewhere. So, you know, I was getting kind of that pushback or feedback on it. And I was hearing about estrangement everywhere. It seemed like all of a sudden I was hearing it on podcasts. I was seeing it in the advice columns. And I started thinking, well, those are the books that seem to sell when they are kind of about this bigger topic. And I was estranged from my parents for 16 years. I could make an estrangement. So that's kind of how it happened.
Interesting. All right. I'm going to surprise you with something.
Okay.
You write in the book, and this is in chapter 2, after a month of saying goodbye to my dad at the airport, I was riding home from work on the northbound Clark Street bus. The CTA driver swerved and pulled over in the middle of the block. He opened the door, stepped out, and walked away. I know who that bus driver was.
Oh, my God. Are you kidding me?
I am not.
Oh, tell me the story. Oh, my God. This is amazing.
I actually don't have much of a story except for the fact that this is someone who, and I got to be, I do not have permission to say who it is.
Okay,
but it was
fine.
It was someone who worked here, who has mental health issues.
Oh.
Who decided to become a bus driver. And like, it was not a good day. And it's so him. It is so, because I remember this particular person. My office used to be downstairs at Second City on the same level, like next to the bar, which is next to the main stage theater. He was in as part of the rehearsal process for a show and got upset, came in to complain or yell about it to me, opened my window and threw a potted plant out the window, almost killing a very famous person at the time. And so we like, and I never even talked to him about the story. I know about the story. I cross-checked the dates. It appears to be the,
oh my
the
God.
Person.
That's but so what, amazing.
What then you need to know is this is a person who worked for Second City, worked for Saturday Night Live, who decided to be a bus driver for about 5 minutes. It broke him, and he left, and he went on to be broken in some other way. But I was like reading this. I'm reading this thing, and I'm like, Anne, my wife said, and I go, who is this sound like? She goes, I know exactly what it sounds like.
Oh
and
my
I'm
gosh.
Emailing people. Yeah.
That's so amazing. So can I explain to the audience
yes.
why that's in the book? Okay.
Please.
So the reason that's in the book is, you know, I have a frustrating relationship with my dad. And at this point, I haven't figured out why.
Why?
Right? And so I'm on this bus and I'm trying to go home. And normally if they change drivers, for those of you who don't know the CTA, they pull up at a bus stop and there's a driver standing there and the new driver gets on and maybe there's a few minutes where they do some stuff and then they, you know, you continue on your way. And this guy literally like middle of the block, pulled over, opened the door and just walked off. And we're all sitting there looking at each other. We're going, what is happening? And I was furious. I was so angry and I was just more and more and more mad. And I come from a family where A, we were not allowed to be angry and B, nice girls don't get angry. So I was not comfortable being angry. So I go to therapy a couple days later and I'm ranting about this bus driver and my very calm Brooks Brothers blue shirt, khaki wearing therapist, whose name is David McKay, who's unfortunately passed now, but amazing person, looked at me and he said, Stephanie, did you talk to your father this week?
Nailed.
And I was like, why? What are you talking about? Why? And he's like, is it possible you're angry at your dad and not the bus driver? And I was like, why are you being so stupid? Why are you asking me about? I'm mad at the bus driver, David. So, you know, I had a lot of transference, a lot of dissociation, which I talk about in the book. And it's super common for people who have had childhood trauma to transfer and to not understand why they're mad. And oftentimes I didn't know that I was angry until like a week or 3 weeks later about something. So I cannot believe that you know who that was. That's amazing. But also, let's get back to storytelling, right? So if you and I had been working on this book, say, and you then learned, we'd be like, okay, so how do we incorporate this? Because clearly there's this connection that we have to incorporate in some way. And there's a character in the book who didn't seem like an important character. He was a mechanic in Cleveland, Ohio, who fixed our Hearst camper. Yes, you're hearing that right. Hearst camper. And he showed up two more times in the story, but I wasn't registering that he was. And I have this wonderful friend, writing teacher named Janine Ouellette, who has a wonderful Substack called Writing in the Dark. And she read it and she said, "This guy's important." I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "Well, he's important because he's here and he's here." And I was like, "Oh my God, he's the one." And I don't want to reveal why he's so important at the end, but he's really important at the end. And so I thought, oh, I shouldn't have anything in this story that's not important or shouldn't be there. There shouldn't be nothing tangential. And I'm sure you know that from theater, right? If there's a prop on the stage, the prop gets used. It's not just sitting there for no reason. So those of you who are thinking about writing stories or telling stories or doing presentations, you want to think about which of those stories you want to choose. That's one of the things I do with clients is I assess, okay, bring me three stories that we might be able to use and we'll talk about them and we'll assess why they're important or not important or relevant, or are they doing the job that needs to get done here? That's really the purpose in it.
Well, I think too, with the food, there is a like you smell it, you can taste it. It's tactile and it, especially when you're dealing with difficult subject matter, it allows you to be like, okay, I know what this is. It's if not comfortable to me. I mean, when you talk about anything from like anise cookies or whatever, it's like, I haven't lost it. Right. I thought about, I'm like, I know it. I know that taste. I know it from the time of year that it appears. And so like, I'm curious too, for you, Did you know going in that you were going to use that as a theme, or did it emerge as you were doing the writing?
So the book was generated from the recipe box.
It's from the recipe. So,
and
yeah.
So I started writing, thinking maybe they were going to be blog posts. I had a food blog and I,
yep,
you know, would write one and then I'd write another. And then I was like 15,000 words into something. And I was like, oh, I think I'm writing a memoir and I have no idea how to do that. I better find a class. So just because I'd been a technical writer and I'd written four books previously doesn't mean I know how to write memoir. Back to your point about, you know, do you need a speaking coach if you've done a particular type of speaking before? So, and I held on to the recipes as a device for a really long time. There's about 90 drafts of this book. I rearranged it 12 times, completely restructured it. And it wasn't until the very last one that the recipes actually weren't in the book anymore because they didn't need to be there. And I had a friend who read it a bunch of times and kept saying stuff. I think you don't need the recipes. I think the story is strong enough, but the food is still in there. So the food, the stories, you know, when I was a young woman in Chicago, there's a whole chapter about sort of learning how to be in my physical body in Chicago. And you know, our goal was to eat our way up Clark Street. And so I had Ethiopian food for the first time. So that's the description in that chapter, which represents, you know, you eat with your hands and it's messy and it's fun and the flavors are intense. And I'm like this very white girl from Connecticut. So literally all the food I had in Chicago just blew my mind. And so that, you know, I wanted people to have that kind of visceral experience. Or when I made the first time I made dinner for my now husband was it's a pasta alla puttanesca, which is horse spaghetti. And it's, you know, it's got capers and anchovies and olive oil and it's sizzling in the pan. And that's very sensual, right? So those are the things that people can relate to because everyone eats. Everyone has some kind of family food memories. Even if you didn't grow up with a mom, you know, it doesn't have to be a mom. It can be a grandmother or whatever. And so they're very embedded in us and who we are.
The Chicago stuff's hilarious, especially for those of us who live here. Because one of the times you talk about visiting the space time tanks on Lincoln Avenue, which I mean, again, I work at Sega, I drove by those things all the time. I did it once. I did not enjoy it. I got way into my head, but it made sense in terms of in the telling of your story, because it's just another thing that was leading you towards an understanding of why you were doing the things or being the things or thinking the things that you just weren't able to access yet.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of people who suffer from trauma, especially young, you become disassociated from your body or disembodied. That's where the word comes from, right? So you're not attached. You don't really know how you're feeling. You forget to go to the bathroom, you know, even though you have the urge for 2 hours. So there's, you know, you're not comfortable being hugged, maybe. I loved hugging. I always did. But, you know, that chapter was about really kind of being embodied. And then I kind of stepped back from that once I kind of knew what was going on.
There's a moment where you're talking to your mom about her father, your grandpa, and she just says he wasn't a nice man. It's a very, like, when you're writing the movie, by the way, that's like a crucial moment. What insights did you glean from that conversation? Did that change your relationship with your mom, kind of knowing that? It feels like that's how it got processed, but I'm not sure what happened in the moment.
She did not want to talk about her father. And so my mom grew up during the Depression in Queens, New York. What I knew about him was very little, didn't know his name, and never saw a photo of him until they were going to move. And a lot of people our age have this experience where their parents are moving and you have to go help them clean out their house and you're going through pictures, mementos, or their parent has died and you're trying to figure out what to do with all this stuff. So it was one of those sort of moments, although they were retiring. And I found all these pictures of who I assumed was her father. So it was a way to get her to talk about him because she hadn't wanted to. I didn't realize it was because he was a violent, drunk, and abusive. And that's why she was so terribly shut down and so, you know, terribly broken as a person that kind of caused her to end up with someone who did terrible things to her kids, you know? So it's a sad story for that. I do recall this, like, that happened, like the conversation, and she was cooking, right? So she's frying onions in a pan as she usually started every meal that she made. And she, you know, she was like, I don't want to talk about this, you know, kind of, you know, like, wasn't like, you know, and then it was like, and then she had the sentences, like the three or four things that she was willing to say that were so devastating. Yeah. And after that, I was like, and this was before I knew what had happened to me. I was 28. I was in therapy. I was trying to figure stuff out. So I was, you know, I actually probably had an assignment from my therapist, like, try to get your mom to talk about some of this X, Y, or Z while you're there, you know? And so I got more about her than I had. And I certainly had a sense of, oh, okay. Now, I didn't know until much later, she did not talk to him after she turned 18. So she had a lifelong estrangement from her own father. She didn't know where he was buried, when he died. I found those things out and kind of did a pilgrimage on her behalf. But it's, you know, it's how trauma is or is not processed, right? That's kind of what the story is about.
Yeah. We had on the podcast a guy named James Kimmel Jr. a while back, and he had a book on the science of revenge. And it was like one of these book titles that like popped at me. I'm like, I have no idea what this, I mean, I know what the title's about. Let's have him on. And as I dug into it, he was a lawyer. He had his own revenge stories, did research, ended up at Yale, has a very compelling argument that revenge is like addiction in terms of the science of it. And his only antidote to like curing yourself from revenge is forgiveness. And it was a very powerful episode. It was like really downloaded a bunch. And this is probably for me one of the most powerful aspects of the book, because you forgave your parents, your dad, that wasn't returned. But that wasn't the point. And I think in part what I've learned over time with regard to this, at least this particular aspect of things, is that like, it's the forgiveness is part is for you. It is so you're not carrying around someone else's garbage or whatever you want to call it, worse. And the book is really like, you could have been, well, it's interesting. That's the title of the book. Cause I was about to say you could be bitter, and there's bitter aspects of it.
Right.
But not this part. You believe that forgiveness was correct. Like that was what you needed, right?
Absolutely. So the book is called Bitter, Comma, Sweet. Yeah, and comma. It's both of, yeah, the comma is important. Mm-hmm. you know, for me, I had been not talking to my parents for 15 or 16 years at that point. And I had, in the back of my mind, I was working on forgiveness. I wasn't consciously working on forgiveness. When I went to clean out my last house when we were moving, I found an entire file folder full of articles about forgiveness that I had clipped over that time period and not even realized it. So I was reading about it. I was kind of thinking about it. And I certainly read the book Forgive for Good by Frederick Luston at, I think he's the Stanford Forgiveness Project, which is amazing. And so, you know, theoretically, you know, I was thinking about it, but it's galling to have to deal with this and not get an acknowledgement and to have to do all this work and spend all this money on therapy and have it affect your relationships and your finances and just all these things, right? So, you know, I've certainly was in a lot of rooms where people are like, F them, I'm not gonna, you know. And so, and I had, for sure, I am no saint. I was furious and angry, and there's like full journals just full of the F-bomb, just page after page of it, you know. So, so I had all that. I expressed all of that. But then I got to this place where, you know, I got married. My parents weren't there. That felt weird. And not to say, like, I don't think I would have wanted my father to walk me down the aisle because of what had happened, but it felt weird that they weren't there. And I started to want it. I was asking, who do I want to be, right? This is part of the question in this book. Is who do I want to be in my life? Who do I want to be in the world? And the person I want to be is a person who is able to forgive and to be generous. And there's a scene in El Salvador that when I went to El Salvador, that I never understood that experience until I wrote this book and finally figured out that forgiveness and generosity are two sides of the same coin. I want to be a generous person. And it's a generous thing to forgive someone who is not said they're sorry, not acknowledged something happened, and also maybe isn't capable of that, or they've restructured it in their mind so they think it's something else. So for me, it really felt like I thought it was affecting my health, which it probably did. And I also just didn't want to carry it anymore. You know, there's that scene in The Martian where he finally figures out how to heat the rover by digging up the radioactive isotope, right? And I'm like, that's kind of what it felt like. I'm carrying around somebody else's radioactive isotope. And I didn't want to do that anymore. So, and then there was a big hiccup because when I reached out to them, something happened that was very frustrating. I absolutely could have said, nope, I'm out. I'm done. And I chose not to. I don't want to spoil it because I do want people to read the books.
Well, I mean, the one positive I know what you're referring to is this pastor. They had a pastor, right? That helped facilitate. And the pastor believed you.
She did. Then that blew my mind because, you know.
I mean, that's huge.
It's huge. And that was the first thing she said to me when I reached out to her was, oh, he told me right basically when I first met him. And I thought, what? Like, why would he tell someone that? And then she's like, and I believe you. And I thought, okay, well, so he must be giving off some kind of vibe because my dad was Dale Carnegie trained, a salesman. Everybody loved him, could talk to anybody, church deacon, didn't come across like a creepy, you know, guy. Like he really didn't. But she must have known on some level, however he told her that, oh, this actually did happen. So she was willing to help try to facilitate a reconciliation. And she ultimately did.
So you finish, I mean, I know the experience of finishing writing a book, but not a book like this. And I'm curious. So like you finish writing it. Did you feel like that was another sort of evolution in your journey I'm not going to say get past this because you don't get past it. Incorporate into your narrative in a way that allows you to move more freely through the world.
I learned so much about myself and my family working on this. And for anybody who has a difficult family, like a lot of people will do genealogy. And I think that's a sort of similar thing where you're trying to understand like, oh, did we have Confederates in the family? Or did we have, you know, this kind of person or that kind of person? And, you know, I learned about who my mother, I think, was on a different level than I experienced her, which was helpful because then you can see the person in a broader sense. The thing that I think helped me honestly the most was when I did the final version, which is the estrangement focused version, because I added all this cultural context and that put my life into context as well. And I think it does that for readers as too. Like if you understand that, you know, there was this whole organization called the False Memory Syndrome Association, and they were seeding the media with stories about how all these terrible therapists were planting memories in their clients so that these good Christian upstanding men were going to get attacked. Oh gosh, you know, that actually happened to me, but now I understand how it happened, like where that came from. And so things like that really helped me to kind of understand, like nobody used the word estrangement when I was not talking to my parents. Nobody used the word no contact is another, you know, common term now. You see that on TikTok, but people have been estranging themselves from their families forever, you know, like get on a boat in Ireland and go to the, you know, America, and then you never have to see those people again. And there might be multiple reasons why people did that, but possibly because those people were not great people and you wanted to get away from them. So I think that was where I learned maybe the most, was doing the additional material, like talking to Molly Howes, who's a psychiatrist who is the author of A Good Apology, Four Things to Make Things Right, and reading that book, but then being able to incorporate our conversation into the book, because wanting an apology is what a lot of people get hung up on. And, you know, at some point, most people have to figure out, get to the place where you recognize that my version of what happened and this person's version of what happened are never going to mesh. So I either have to be okay with that, or I have to, you know, I can't move forward with this person. And that's essentially what I decided to do.
Yeah. I think a thing that at least I've realized as I've gotten older that I had no idea existed because there was no schema for it, was understanding these various moral panics that happen and how they're almost always in regard to the dominant paradigm trying to keep everything like underneath, like the children on milk cartons. That was not happening. There was not suddenly a rash of kids being kidnapped. What there was women going to work, and certain people deciding, and I would guess that the people behind these things, 80% of them don't know that it's not a real thing, but it feels like, oh my God, that pops up in our culture time and time again. Right now for me, it's the sort of Jonathan Haidt focus problem of like phones are the problem for everyone. If we just take the phones away, there'll be no problems. I'm like, I get that there's a problem on phones. I've got issues with gambling on phones, all this sort of thing. But also that allows you to ignore, oh, I don't know, the problem between the richest people and the poorest people in this country, guns, like a variety of other things that might be problematic that are a part of the power paradigm. And so when you sort of discover and talk about that, that's such a wonderful way of making the personal political in some regard, which I know you as an individual is something you think about. So the richness of this book and why I think people should pick it up is it is your story. But, you know, you're an experienced storyteller who knows that it's like it's more than just your story. It's many people's story. It's about other stories around that. It's about food at some point too, and what that means for us, because it is important. By the way, I had Ethiopian last night.
Oh, I'm jealous.
Yeah, Damara from in Chicago. So you know, and that makes it more than I think just a memoir. We always end the podcast by asking our guests for a yes and story, and I'm very curious as to what yours might be.
So I'm going to say that my yes and story was when I went to the first TEDx San Diego in 2010, I was asked, do you want to join the team? And if I had said no, my life would be completely different now. So saying yes to that, joining as a volunteer, because all TEDx's are run by volunteers, I was a curator on that team for 5 years. I got to meet the most incredible people. And sadly, some of them have now passed away. And just being able to have known them on such a brief moment, but a very deep level. I kind of joke that there's no such thing as a trauma-informed speech coach, but if there was, that's me. Because, you know, I've had a lot of experiences where, like, my recollection of working with you, Callie, was that we started and then you found out that Nora was ill. And yeah, so then the question was, do I continue? And I'm never going to tell someone, you have to do this, right? That's not my job for sure. But also, you're not the first person I've worked with who's had a massive tragedy in the middle of me coaching them. And so part of what I think you asked me earlier about kind of being with those hard stories is sometimes it's just sitting with the person and letting yeah. them be where they are and, you know, letting them figure out where they want to go with it, if they want it to be on stage or not. Oftentimes I tell people, like I say people, it's not therapy, but there will be moments that will feel like therapy. And that's why you need to pick someone that you trust to work with, because it is very vulnerable to go on stage. And oftentimes the really vulnerable stuff, the person doesn't necessarily need to put on stage, but they need to work it out with somebody. And that somebody is sometimes me. So I'm super grateful that I said yes to that. And it did make an enormous difference in my life. I'm 15 years into this business and I've met incredible people, work with people all over the world. And now have a story that I've been able to put out as well. So thank you so much for having me. It's been wonderful.
Oh, yeah. Well, and it was funny because I talked yesterday. They asked me to talk to the new hires at Second City. And I think it's in part because I'm turning 60 this year. Just had this heart surgery, have gone through what I've gone through, that it was really important for me to say to them, everything in your work, your experience at Second City, but also your life is going to be about your relationships. That at the end of the day, none of us do this alone. We're always going to need other people. And so your ability to sort of build a variety of these different relationships is absolutely key to your happiness, your success, your flourishing, whatever you call it. And when stuff's down, like when it's bad, that's who you're going to rely on. And when stuff's good, you don't want to celebrate alone. You know, that's where you need that. So remember that as you're working in ensembles with other people. And in the case of you and I too, like what I would have lost not having that relationship. And you are right. She got sick during that period, which I completely had forgot. And I think maybe part of the reason we bonded so quickly is because you'd had that experience. You let me sit with it. I appreciated it. And it allowed us to sort of, because I remember giving that talk and we were fairly early in the process. So there was still a lot of like, we don't know where this thing's going to go. And so, you know, and it didn't end with the story that I wanted to tell, but there are other stories to tell. And then eventually you tell those. So, right. And that's something you're doing as well. The book is called Bittersweet, How to Heal Yourself When Your Family is Broken. Stephanie, thanks so much for coming on the pod.
Thank you for having me.
Getting DS And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.